Fine. So, what we'll do tonight, Be'ezrat Hashem, is we are going to talk about issues with children, and babies. That'll be the first half. The second half, we'll talk about instructing non-Jews on Shabbat. We'll talk about that briefly. And then we'll have a chance to discuss some questions. And then we'll talk about the plans for the coming series next term after Pesach and Be'ezrat Hashem the coming year as well, after the Chagim 2019 going into 2020. So let's. So if you remember last time we went into Muktzah, recall we did Muktzah and we did illnesses and all of that. So now we're going to talk about children and babies, and of course we have to talk about, we begin with, a woman giving birth on Shabbat. So, what happens? What are you allowed to do? What are you not allowed to do? Etc. So, of course, we know that a woman who's in childbirth is, of course, pikuach nefesh. We mentioned in previous shiurim that that, of course, overrides any of the obligations of Shabbat, and the woman is allowed to break Shabbat, and people are allowed to do so for her. For the purposes of delivering her child. The question is, when is a woman considered to be in childbirth? From what stage? Right. So, the halacha tells us, this is based on the Gemara, tells us three different symptoms when you can say for sure that a woman is considered to be a woman who is giving birth to a child and life is in danger. Number one is when she can no longer walk, she needs support to walk. Number two, she starts bleeding. And number three is when she sits down on the birth stool. She actually sitting ready to give birth. Only those three are considered to be pikuach nefesh. Until then, it's not pikuach nefesh. So you may be thinking to yourself, so that means I have to wait to call the ambulance only when my wife can no longer walk, the contractions are so strong that she can't walk anymore, or when she's bleeding, that's the only time. No, because you have to be in a situation where when these three, one of these three symptoms will happen, you will be already in an environment where you can be protected. So the time it takes, you don't know exactly, but realistically speaking, the time it takes to get to one of these three symptoms and the time it takes to get to hospital, that you can add on to that time. So say, for example, it all depends on how far you live from the hospital. So if say you live round the corner from the Royal Free, and we'll talk about in a moment whether you're obligated to actually go and spend the Shabbat near the hospital. But let's say you live round the corner, you're staying round the corner from the Royal Free, and it takes you a couple of minutes to get to the hospital. So then you would only be allowed to go to the hospital and start doing things, start calling people to come with you, etc. Only when you're very near to that stage. If however you live half an hour or so, you live far away from the hospital and it takes time for the taxi to come, to drive there, to be admitted, all of this can be taken into account. And therefore, the general halachic guidance is, when a woman is having contractions, that once every 15 minutes or so, on a regular basis, that's considered a state. Again, this is very general, because some women can straight away, they can have a baby within a few minutes, you know, a few, not long after that. It all depends. But generally speaking, once there are steady and regular contractions, every 15 to 20 minutes or so, then she's considered a chole, an ill person, and you can do anything for her, break Shabbat totally for her. And that means doing anything, right? Anything necessary to ensure the safety of herself and the fetus. And this includes, by the way, psychological help. And you may recall from a couple of weeks ago, two, 3 weeks ago, we talked about how a child locked up, you're allowed to break Shabbat, even biblically, because a child locked up mentally, it's dangerous. Similarly, a woman's psychological needs are paramount when it's coming to her delivering a child. And anything which she demands, one is obligated to fulfill. So her husband, provided she wants him to be with her at childbirth, which, hopefully that's the case, he is allowed to come with, although he's not doing anything, right? He's not administering any medical care.
He's holding a hand.
Well,
she's abusing him.
She's abusing him, why is that?
You want me to explain?
I didn't understand that one, but fine. Everything's been recorded. any psychological help is if she wants her husband to be there, then the husband has to go with and he has to break Shabbat. Similarly, if she says, I want my mother to be here, and I can't give her my mother, I want her to come with me, then the mother is allowed to get in the car and drive to the hospital and be with her. Because anything which adds to her psychological and mental well...
So if the mother is not there, you can call her? Somebody can call her to...
Yes, yes, correct. But let me just get through a bit and we'll take questions soon. We have time for questions now. So anything for the psychological well-being of the child, of the mother I mean, because that Chachamim understood, a woman cannot deliver her baby safely without being not just physically safe, but also psychologically safe as well. Therefore she's allowed to call. Not just that, furthermore, we have a very interesting halakha that, let's say a doctor, or even the husband, let's say they go into labor on Friday night, and she gives birth on Friday night, and it's a long Shabbat afternoon, we're coming out of the summer, Shabbat doesn't come out at 10:30. The husband, he has to stay, how can husband get home? Now, royal free, you can walk home, let's say you're in a hospital far away, or you can't actually walk home. Is there any halakhic justification for the person who accompanied the woman to go back home? Is there? No. What's the justification? It's over. There's no danger anymore. She's given birth health to a healthy baby, a safe baby, everything's fine.
You might not go in the first place.
Excellent. So halakha tells us that you're allowed to go back and break Shabbat because we're concerned that if you weren't allowed to go back, then people would be hesitant in going in the first place. And this is all part of the well-being of the mother. And to ensure that she's well accompanied, she's well looked after. But there's a big debate whether you can do d'oraita. The halakha is only drabbanans. So the husband himself wouldn't be allowed to, generally speaking, the husband himself wouldn't be allowed to drive home, but he could order a taxi and get in the taxi and go home. All the more so if there's children at home, there's a danger. Because if you don't allow the... if you don't allow the husband or the person accompanying her to go with her in the first to go back, then they won't want to go with her in the first place. So that's important halakha to know. With a doctor, for example, or hatzala, they're even allowed to drive home themselves. I'm not going to go into reasons for it. There's a whole discussion about it, partly based on the fact they may be needed again in the area. But what's important to know is that wherever she demands, we must listen to her and break Shabbat for her. But the interesting here, although we said quite a few leniencies here, is that we said a few weeks ago that when it comes to a person who's in danger, you do everything, you don't have to do anything with a shinui. You can do it straight out. Right? You need to, a person's ill, he's had a heart attack, you break Shabbat regularly. When it comes to a woman, though, in childbirth and labor, because this is a regular occurrence, and yes, it can be dangerous, but in the words of the Rambam, 1 in 1,000 die in labor, that's what Rambam wrote in his time. Therefore, you must try to do everything with a shinui, with a deviation, as long as it doesn't slow down the process. So generally speaking, you need to call the hospital, so you pick up the receiver with your left hand, or you dial them, you push in the buttons with your left hand, and so on and so forth. You do everything with as much shinui, with as much deviation as possible, provided it's not literally an emergency where she has to be rushed to hospital. Then of course you would have to do it as quick as possible. But if there's no rush, then you should do everything with as big a deviation as possible, because this is common for women to go through labor, and therefore that's the halakha that she shouldn't. Anyone doing breaking Shabbat for her should do it in a shinui. Because of this, from one point, a woman in the ninth month, the poskim tell us, from the beginning of the ninth month, 4 to 5 weeks before the due date, she should arrange everything in a bag and make sure that if she gives birth on Shabbat, there'll be as little desecration of Shabbat as possible. So that means keeping the lights on in the prominent place. We normally keep switch the lights off in different rooms, but here keep the lights on just in case if she needs to give birth in a room, the lights are on already. You don't have to break Shabbat. Similarly, have the money ready in the front of the house, exact amount of change, you find out how much a taxi costs, you find out what you pre-book with, whatever it is, but you do as much, as many preparations as possible from before Shabbat, so the Hilul Shabbat, the desecration Shabbat, will be as little as possible. Similarly, keep the urn on, so that if you need the hot water bottle, whatever it may be, a hot drink, you won't have to heat up the kettle. If you didn't do that, you forgot to, then of course you could boil the kettle, of course you could. But anything which you think, keep your phone on, don't switch your phone off. Although normally you say switch your phone off on Shabbat, and you know, hey, keep your phone on. So you don't have to do the extra switching it on Shabbat, which is going to be an extra violation. Of course it's mutar, but as little, as much as possible, a person should try to prevent from happening on Shabbat.
I want to ask, you said better to order a taxi than to drive yourself.
On the way back home.
On the way back home.
Yeah.
So you could drive yourself on the way
home. On the way there, theoretically you could. Theoretically you could. Because you're allowed to break Shabbat yourself. And because there's a just as good alternative asking an Andrew, then why yourself break Shabbat?
Because in any case you have to pay. I'm trying to work out if there's more
money. No. Paying's what's paying? It's more muktzeh, the Rabbanan.
Right.
Not comparable to yourself driving the car.
Right.
But if you suspect, if it's a busy day, let's say, and they say it's Christmas Day or something like that, and taxis take 20 minutes to get there or something, then of course you drive yourself.
Yes.
If there's no reason for the non-Jew to, the taxi, to go any slower than you are, then order a taxi. You know, picking up the phone is the Rabbanan, paying the money is the Rabbanan. It's all the Rabbanan there. So why yourself go in the car, it's, you know. But if you needed to, then it would be mutar to do so. Following childbirth, then there's three stages of a woman's status. The first 3 days, that means the first 72 hours after she gives birth, then we break Shabbat for her, even if she says she doesn't need. So let's say the doctor or the husband, they've come home. You know, the next day you come home, she gave birth on Thursday night, she came home on Friday afternoon for Shabbat, and they rushed home, and the husband feels it's a bit cold at home, she's saying it's fine, don't worry, I feel good. The husband feels no, and he's allowed to switch on the heating, switch on the boiler, within the first 3 days after Shabbat, even if she said don't need, but someone else believes that she does need, and realistically, not just because he wants to be hot as well, obviously, you have to be honest with yourself, then you could switch it on, you could do anything for her, boil, and if she says, he says, you need a hot drink, you don't look good, saying, I'm fine, don't worry, but the first 3 days, then you don't have to listen to her. From days 4 to 7, then, whatever she asks for, you do. Whatever she asks for, however irrational it is, if she says she doesn't need it, then listen to her. But if she asks, I need something, and you feel, no, it's not so cold, I don't think it's enough. Whatever she asks for, you're allowed to do from days 4 to 7. Following a week, from days 80 to 30, she has the status of a chole she'en basakana, so level 3, which we talked about last time, in that she's bedridden, and that she can ask the non-Jew to do anything for her. So you can ask the repair to go and buy you something from the shop, and bring it home. And you yourself can do anything with a shinui, any drabanan with a shinui, and like we said last time, perhaps even a doraita with a shinui. We won't go into that again. We said that 2 weeks ago, but unless, look, of course, sometimes the complications after birth, and that, then she will still have a status of a chole with a sakana. I'm talking about a regular childbirth after a week, and she's got a status of a regular ill person, and then from days 8 to 30, she can ask a non-Jew to do anything for her. And she herself can do any rabbinic prohibition with a deviation. Very interesting halakha, which today is, you know, this is already brought down from some time ago, is that a woman who miscarries was anything after 40 days has the status of a yoledet, of a woman who's given birth. That's a big chidush, that, because today, you know, a woman can have a miscarriage after 10, 12 weeks. And to say it's the same status as a woman who's given birth is quite, you know, it's interesting. But that's the halakha. As long as a woman has carried a fetus for over 40 days, then she has the status of a yoledet, of a woman who's given birth. So stillbirth for sure, certainly. Even a miscarriage has the status and you may break Shabbat for her for any needs, etc. Because there is a danger to the mother, although the baby's not there, but the danger to the mother, and therefore you're allowed to. So that's with regards to childbirth. Any specific questions on childbirth or labour, anything else?
The first three conditions you mentioned didn't include breaking water.
No. Breaking water is a stage actually before that, which isn't yet. But normally when the waters are broken, unless you're living next door to the hospital, normally that actually indicates that you're very close. And therefore you would be able to call a taxi, be able to get there. There is a discussion that was here, I'm not going to go into it because other facets you're allowed, whether you have to actually, before Shabbat, during the ninth month, go and stay over in the hospital nearby so you can walk. Because you may end up having the baby on Shabbat and you have to go in the taxi and drive yourself, right? But the halakha is you don't need to. You don't need to. If you want to, it's definitely a good thing to do so, but there's no halakhic requirement to do so. But there is a big discussion in the poskim about, and some actually do require you, if possible, to go and spend Shabbat to a nearby hospital so you'll be able to walk there and not have to break Shabbat, should you give birth on Shabbat. So the baby's born, and you want to use baby wipes. Are you allowed to use baby wipes on Shabbat? Okay, this is a common question people often ask, and as you can imagine, there's a big debate about it. What's the issue? The issue is squeezing, right? Using a baby wipe, you're squeezing the water out of the wipe. And if you recall from our earlier, from the last beginning of the winter, squeezing water, squeezing a liquid out of cloth on Shabbat is forbidden. And here you are using the liquid, the water which you are squeezing out, you're using it. So seemingly using a baby wipe would be prohibited. And that's why many do prohibit using a baby wipe on Shabbat. However, Chacham Avadia and others hold that one may use a baby wipe on Shabbat, provided you don't squeeze it. You just rub it smoothly and gently over the surface area, then you're allowed to. Why? Because his rationale is that you're just taking the moisture on the surface area. And therefore, those who use baby wipes, there is a lachic basis to do so. In some of the baby wipes today, I think the brother is writing this 20 years ago, 15, 10 years ago, right? Some of the baby wipes today are so wet, you just touch them and water comes out of them, you have to be careful. But in any case, if you do use baby wipes on Shabbat, you have to make sure that you don't squeeze them, and neither when you don't rub them with force, because then you're definitely squeezing out water from the baby wipe. You do it gently, and you take the moisture off the surface area, then that's fine to use on Shabbat itself. Warming up milk for.
So what do you use, like cotton, like?
Well, those who don't use baby wipes.
A towel and like oil or something. How do you clean the babies?
Those who don't use baby wipes.
Yeah.
Those who don't use baby wipes. You wash. Pour water on it and then just wipe off with a dry tissue.
You can wash.
That's
them.
What they will do. Or do you wash them?
Wash them.
Yeah, you can wash. Yeah, you can wash under the sink. Yeah, you can do that. But as I said, when you cut your one is allowed to use baby wipe, but as provided you don't squeeze it, you just use the surface area. That's more tough to do on Shabbat. Warming up milk formula. Are you allowed to warm up milk for the baby on Shabbat? So let's say you have a bottle of milk, either expressed milk or formula milk, whatever it is, and you now want to, it's cold milk, and heat it up. Are you allowed to heat it up? So what would you say from what you learned in the past? And be sure
you can do klish
for the What did you say?
Third or second.
Okay, Kisheni. Don't forget there's a bottle here.
Yeah.
So, not only could you pour water out from the urn into a cup or and then submerge the bottle into it, but you could even pour hot water from the urn, not into the bottle, but on the bottle. On the plastic bottle. The reason being is that pouring from a Kli Rishon, pouring from the urn is considered pouring from a Kli Rishon. And pouring from a Kli Rishon only cooks, can only permit Kedei Klipa, only a slice, only the surface area can cook. And therefore, here the milk is within the bottle. So all the pouring does is just heating the plastic bottle itself. It's not actually changing it. The milk itself is considered a Kli Sheni, and therefore one may pour, provided there isn't cold water on the bottle, on the urn, you dry the bottle, then you may pour water directly from the urn onto it in order to heat up the milk, the cold milk in it. Or just easier, just pour from the urn into a bowl or something, and then you put the bottle in. Can you submerge the bottle all the way in? Or can you submerge the bottle all the way into the liquid?
No.
Why not? Atmanana. So we learned that you can't cover things on Shabbat. You can't insulate them. But you are allowed to submerge it fully. Because Hatmana is only with the Kli Rishon or the Kli Sheni. The reason for Hatmana is you'll come to heat up before. I'm not going to the reasons for it. And that doesn't apply with the Kli Sheni. And therefore one may totally submerge the bottle into the hot water on Shabbat for the purposes of heating up the milk for the baby. Just take a couple more points and then we'll take some questions. Next is, can I use cream for a nappy rash? So again, we've touched on this in the past. So remember we said that a child is considered, a baby definitely is considered a chole, an ill person. Well, the baby's healthy. Child, a baby, its needs are considered a chole, and therefore there's no problem of doing medicine on Shabbat to the baby. The problem is, can you use cream? Can you smear cream? So we've said in the past, you're only allowed to use cream on Shabbat if you rub it all the way in and there's no layer left on the surface area. So you do it in very small amounts. You rub in oil, definitely you can, by the way, because oil is runny. I'm talking about thick cream. Even thick cream, which Ashkenazim don't allow, we do allow, provided you take small amounts at a time and it's worked in so that there isn't a layer of cream on the baby after you have rubbed it onto it.
That's avoid spreading.
Yes, it's avoid spreading, exactly. The spreading is only when there's a layer left at the end. What happens if it's cold and heating's off and you have a young child, a 1-year-old baby in the room? This is a very important principle.
To be old man as well.
Sorry?
To be old man.
Can be?
To be old man.
Old person.
An old man as well.
Yeah, 1 second. Yeah. So, there's a principle, kol cholim etzel atzina, which means when it comes to being cold, then we get very lenient, because being cold is a very uncomfortable situation. And the basis behind this is that, first thing to say about halakha is that if it's extremely cold, and the Shulchan Aruch writes, it says, not like those people when it's just a bit cold, they start to rely on this heter. It's been real cold, it says. So when it gets real cold, then you are allowed to directly instruct a non-Jew to do any doraita, to switch on the heating in the house. Although you're not ill, but you're extremely cold, you're allowed to. And the rationale behind this is very simple, is that we take on, a person who's very cold will probably end up becoming ill. And you don't have to wait till you become ill to rely on the heterim, which we've discussed. Because the situation that you're in, it's possible and quite probable that you'll end up becoming ill. Therefore, those heterim, those leniencies that you have when you are ill, already kick in now before you're ill. And therefore, if it's extremely cold and it's a chance that you may become ill, as you know can happen, then one is allowed to instruct on. All the more so if there's an old person in the house or there is a baby in the house, then the bar doesn't have to be so high. And even if it's a bit cold, you'll be allowed to. But if it's just average age people at home and it's cold, then one isn't allowed to do this. And if it's very cold, it's snowing or something along those lines, or towards the zero, and there's no heating, the heating went off or something happened, then one's allowed to directly call in on you and instruct him or her to switch on heating on Shabbat. And if there's a baby, as I said, then, of course, even if it's just a bit cold, one may call in the non-Jew to switch it on Shabbat. One final point when it comes to nappies is that some say that when you are opening the nappy, and so you have to open the nappy before Shabbat. Why? Because you are unsealing something which was sewn together. And similarly, when you're finished with a nappy, you're changing the baby, you're finished with a nappy, then be careful not to seal it together and then throw it away, because you're going to be sealing it. But the halakha is that When it comes to opening it, to opening an epi, one is allowed to do so because we mentioned this in the past, that tofer, sewing and sealing together, is only when you cannot unseal it, when it's done on a permanent basis. If it's done on a temporary basis, then it's allowed to. When they make these nappies and manufacture them, their intention is for you to unseal them, and therefore you're allowed to. However, what one should be careful with is when one finishes with a nappy, not to close it on the seals and then throw it away, because that's going to stay for a long time. That's going to stay for permanence, actually. There is a logic to say that it's mutar, but no, it's better. The halakha is that one shouldn't seal them together, then chuck it away. Just put it in a bag and throw it away, as opposed to sealing it and putting it in a bag and disposing of it. That should be avoided during on Shabbat, because you're sealing the two bits together. So that brings us to the end of children and babies on Shabbat. To summarize, we talked about the labor, when the woman's considered to be in labor, and the preparations in the ninth month, and her status afterwards. Talked about baby wipes, that is fine, warming up the milk, cream, switching on the heating for the baby, and finally, the use of nappies on Shabbat. Take two brief questions.
Bathing a baby on Shabbat?
Good point. I was going to mention that. Very good. So generally speaking, we said, remember when we talked about swimming, we said you're not allowed to bathe yourself in water which has been heated on Shabbat. Right? Water has been heated on Shabbat, you're not allowed to use. Even if it's been heated from before Shabbat, one cannot wash his whole body in it. You can wash your limbs, which is why you said that's the main issue with swimming in a pool on Shabbat. The issue is, if the water was heated even from before Shabbat and it's hot, which we said means over 37 degrees or so, then you can't swim in that water on Shabbat. You can't swim in the pool. Because we talked about the reason then, generally speaking, you're not allowed to bathe in hot water on Shabbat, even if it was heated from before Shabbat. However, with a baby though, because of the status of the baby, one may bathe the baby in hot water on Shabbat, provided, of course, there's no other prohibitions involved of, you know, causing more water to be boiled. So if you are going to switch on the hot water tap, you're going to be causing more cold water to come in and become boiled. But if you've closed the system now and no more water is going to come in, and you want the hot water which was heated before Shabbat, or however you had hot water on Shabbat, let's say, Duchemesh, for example, right, a solar panel heating system, then you could bathe the baby on Shabbat in that water, no problem at all, because of the status of the baby. So as long as the water is prepared from before Shabbat and it's hot, you can use it.
Do you take water from the urn and do this thing?
Yeah, exactly. That's a good point. Just be careful you don't do bishul. Yeah, so you have to take water from the urn, that's a klisheni, and then you can put cold water, mix cold water to it. But anyway, it's not going to be... No, what did you say? That's read it, Bo. What did you want to say?
No, I was saying thank you for the baby. But I want to know, in terms of heating, you said there are leniencies in terms of asking a non-Jew when, particularly when people are older and younger people.
Yeah.
What if there is not no non-Jewish person, but it is very cold?
That's a good question. I had this question myself. Because we've said... No, I'll tell you why. Because we said that with the Cholesha in Basakan Hassan, who's bedridden, we said that a Jew, if there's no non-Jew available, then the Jew himself is allowed to do a Doraita with a Shinui.
Right.
But I still think this is different because he's not actually ill. We've done enough to extend the status that you may become ill. That's for asking a non-Jew. For the Jew himself to do that, I had this point, but I didn't find anyone who talks about this and permits it. Which is why I would say it's a sort to do so on Shabbat. Unless a person is literally ill, he's got a cold, then he could, with his shinui, if there's no non-Jew available, turn on the heating.
Okay. What age is a baby?
So, good question. What's Kim say when he no longer needs his mother? 6, 7. Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Fine. So today that would be quite high, that age, you know? Fine. Okay, let's briefly move on to speaking to a non-Jew, instructing a non-Jew on Shabbat to do something for you in Shabbat. So, this is all rabbinic, of course. Asking a non-Jew on Shabbat is only forbidden by the Hachamim, not by the Torah. There is an asmachta, there is a hint to this idea from the Torah which the Hachamim wanted to use the Torah to act as a reminder for this, because the Torah, when it talks about Shabbat, says, Lo ye'aseh kol melacha. It doesn't say, don't do work in the active, it says in the passive, work shall not be done. And from this they understood that this includes that instructing a non-Jew to do work for you. But again, this isn't from the Torah, it's definitely from the Chachamim, and it's important to understand. Asking a non-Jew to do something on Shabbat is forbidden by the Rabbanan, not by the Torah. What's the reason? Why did the rabbis prohibit a person asking a non-Jew to do work for you? So there's three reasons given in the Rishonim. One reason given is, the Rashi says, because otherwise it's like your shliach, it's like your emissary. By him doing it on a rabbinic level, it's like you're doing it yourself. That's one reason given. The second reason given is the Torah, the Navi, Yeshaya, the prophet Isaiah tells us, which we say in Kiddush on Shabbat morning, V'chibadeto me'asot derechecha me'metzo heftzecha v'daber davar. If to honor Shabbat, you know, the way you act during the week is in the way you act on Shabbat. So the way you walk is different. You're not meant to run for no reason. The way you speak on Shabbat isn't meant to be the way you speak during the week. During the week you talk about business, during the week you talk about the football maybe. Shabbat isn't a time where a person indulges in these type of conversations. Right? The speech, the talk of Shabbat is different to the talk of during the week. And when you start telling a non-Jew to do this and to do that, then automatically your dibur, your speech becomes mundane, and you are violating this idea of the daber davar, that your speech on Shabbat should be profane, should be mundane. Rather, should be only good things. And you know, you think about that and what that means. It's quite something. You know, the Shabbat, the way you speak. You know, when you speak others, that you only speak about things which are pertinent to Shabbat. And not to waste Shabbat on speaking things which are not talking about gossip, but just speech which is something which you do during the week, you know, mundane stuff, business, and as they say in Yiddish, like nayas, like you know, just like news and no actual tochen to it. The third reason given is the Rambam says it's a very logical reason, is that you're basically going to kill Shabbat. Yeah, if you have a non-Jew doing everything for you, then you know, you can have your shop open, you can have everything open, you can drive to shul on Shabbat, you just get in the car, you know, there'll be no Shabbat left. And more than that, he says, in the end, what will happen is people end up doing things themselves. If you think about it, if I can ask a non-Jew to do anything, then you know, he's not here, it's gonna get very loose. And this is one of the biggest halachot which Chachamim made the Shabbat. Like Muktz is like a huge drabanan which they made. We have with all the melachot, we have little drabanans, sabka. But we have huge topics which Chachamim made. So Muktz is a huge category they forbade. Another huge one is Amirah la'akum, speaking to a non-Jew, instructing him, because without that, the whole spirit of Shabbat would be gone. And you think about it, and this is a very profound idea. You go back 200 years before that, 2,300 years, we didn't have any of these Rabbanans. You think about it, you could open your shop on Shabbat, you could have a non-Jew sitting there, you know what, you could sit yourself there. How? You're allowed to use money on Shabbat, on a Torah level, you're allowed to exchange. What's wrong with it? Of course, if there's an Erev, if you have an Erev, somebody comes in and pays you money, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with touching money on Shabbat? Which of the 39 melachot do you violate by selling produce on Shabbat? None. And many things which today we wouldn't even think about, on a biblical level, was permissible. So what was Shabbat then? The answer is very simple. There isn't just the laws of Shabbat which we've been doing, there's also the whole spirit of Shabbat. That's how we began the first shiur, all the way back at the beginning of the winter. There's also the spirit of Shabbat. And in time gone by, there was the spirit of Shabbat which people appreciated. And you didn't need all these intricacies. There was a general idea in the spirit of Shabbat that, you know, we just don't do this. This is my work during the week. I don't do this on Shabbat. You don't have to tell me, you have to legislate no coins and no transactions on Shabbat. Because that's just part of, that's what Shabbat means. You're only resting from work. But as time progressed, people started finding loopholes. You know, we can do it like this. We can ask the non-Jew. We can etc. And therefore Chachamim came along with all these takanot, all these remedies and all these ideas to enhance and to preserve the spirit of Shabbat. And so really we are very grateful to Hashem for all these things, because Shabbat would look very different today without Mukta, without these Isurim. What's very important to understand, and this is probably the most important halakha in the whole of these laws with Amirah La'akum, is that there are two elements to it. There is speaking to a non-Jew, and it's having benefit from a non-Jew. And even in cases where you haven't spoken to the Jew, you haven't instructed the Jew directly, if there's benefit, you're not allowed to. And I'll give you a classical example. People often make this mistake. It's pitch black, there's no lights. No lights on. Okay? So people will tell you, I can go and hint to the non-Jew on the street to come in. I can hint. You're not allowed to hint. Because the hinting just gets you around the problem of instructing, of the speech. So that you've got around, because hinting isn't considered speaking. So you haven't instructed the non-Jew. But you're not allowed to directly benefit from the work which a non-Jew does for you on Shabbat. The non-Jew is doing it for you. If he's coming in and he lives there with you, you're sharing a flat with him, and he comes and switches the light on, then fine. He's doing that for himself, could be for you as well, but he's doing it primarily for himself. But if a non-Jew is doing something for you, even if you don't instruct him to do so, just hinted him to do so, you're not allowed to benefit from that. Therefore, if the light is totally off, you're not allowed to even hint to a non-Jew to switch the light on for you. You're only allowed to hint to the non-Jew when there isn't great benefit from the hinting. So, if there is already a slight amount of light in the room, let's say you have the lamppost shining in, there already is light, but you want a bit more light, then you can hint to the non-Jew. Because by hinting, you haven't instructed him, so you've got around the problem of instructing a non-Jew. And benefit-wise, the minimal benefit of you getting a bit more light isn't considered enough of a benefit to prohibit. If it's dark in a basement or somewhere like that, but there's no light and it's actually dark, pitch black, then one isn't allowed to even hint to the non-Jew to come in and switch on the light. That's a false misconception.
He asks you, do you want the light here? You see it's dark.
So again, that would be, then you get around the problem of asking, of instructing. But you start the problem of hana'ah, of benefits. If it's pitch black, you wouldn't be allowed to.
Even if he's coming from his own will, you don't.
He's doing it from his own will, but he's doing it for you. You cannot have benefit, pure benefit, from a meracha which a goy does for you, specifically for you on Shabbat. Now, let me say a few more points, and we'll take questions.
Okay.
Let me just say a few more points. Yeah, quick.
Can you ask the goy before Shabbat?
No. So it depends on the reasons we said before. Good point. If the problem is your speech, then there's no problem. Because you're speaking to him from before Shabbat. The problem of Daber Davar is that your speech on Shabbat shouldn't be like your speech during the week. That's on Shabbat itself. So it wouldn't be a problem me asking him on Friday afternoon to do it. But the other two reasons are still applicable. The reason that he's your emissary, or the reason that it'll end up you doing stuff on Shabbat itself. So you can't. You can't ask a guy on Friday to do things for you on Shabbat.
You don't ask him before Shabbat or in Shabbat. You just come and you see it's dark, he puts it. You don't say anything, not before, nor after Shabbat.
If it's pitch black, the answer is no.
So you have to tell him don't do it?
You have a chovat and mecha'at to stop him from doing so. If he still ended it, you can benefit from it. Yeah. But again, I'm talking about where there's no light, no distant light. In a house, this is going to be quite rare. Because you may want a light in a room, and there's already light in the corridor, so you already got a bit of light in that room.
And what about switching it off?
A good point. Switching it off is mutar. You can hint to him, or he can do it for you. Because switching off the light, it's incidental benefit, if you see what I mean. Because you're not actually getting benefit from him switching the light off. You're getting benefit from being in the dark room, right? So you're not getting direct benefit from the existing melacha of the light being on, right? The light, he switched the light off, and thereby the room is now dark, and you can now sleep in the room. You see? So it's a side hana'ah, and now hana'ah is mutar. So one may hint to a non-Jew to switch the light off on Shabbat, but one may not hint in a dark room where there's no light to switch the light on Shabbat.
If you're staying in a non-Jewish hotel on Shabbat, and all the keys, these are the electric keys, you can ask a member of the staff before Shabbat that when we come into the hotel, can you come upstairs with us and open the door?
Tzetzi, that's called the shoot, because it's two drabbanans there. We'll come to that now. Okay? So now, a few more points with this is as follows. Number one, psik resha through a goy is always mutar. That's an important point, this. What's a psik resha mean? Psik resha, we've said in the past many times, is an inevitable consequence. So let's say I have a fridge and I have a bulb in the fridge, a light. Every time I open the fridge, the light comes on. I didn't take it out before Shabbat. So I myself, if the room is dark, definitely I cannot open this fridge. In order for it's dark, if it's just I can't see the contents of the fridge properly, without the light, I cannot myself open the fridge. Although I only want to take food out of the fridge. But by you doing so, inevitably you're turning the light on, and that's prohibited. But if your intention is just to get something out of the fridge, you can instruct the non-Jew, please come and open my fridge and bring me out the drink. Although, by opening the fridge, he's going to be switching on the lights, but since that's a psik resha, it's not the main activity you're doing, it's an inevitable consequence. By you opening the fridge, by the non-Jew opening the fridge, the light's going to go on, but you're not telling him to do that, and that's not what you want. You just want to get the food out of the fridge, so then you can instruct the non-Jew to open the fridge and take out the drink, although the light comes on. Anything which you're not directly telling him to do it, but it's an inevitable consequence, he's not doing it for that. When he's opening the fridge door, he's not opening it because he wants the light to come on. He's opening it to get the stuff out, as you've asked him to do so. Therefore, that's mutar. A psik resha, and then an inevitable consequence through a goy, is permitted on Shabbat itself. Another important point is, it's only asur to ask a Jew to do something if this is the only way he can do it in the prohibited manner. So if, for example, you have a cleaner or a pair, and you ask the pair, can you clean the dishes? That's fine. Although, most likely, the cleaner is going to switch on the hot water and clean it. But she doesn't have to do that. She could use cold water. And you can wash the dishes, theoretically, using cold water.
She could even put the dishwasher on.
She could if she wants to, for herself. Yeah, not in an Ashkenazi house, no. Because it makes noise. Because it makes noise. Well, does it? Does the dishwasher make noise?
Not anymore.
So, Sephardis can... I don't understand.
Yes.
The dishwasher on,
no, you can't. No, you can't use the dishwasher.
Yeah, I know that. Okay.
So you can ask the au pair to clean the dishes.
Yeah.
And she, of her own will, can go and put it in the dishwasher. Because you're not telling her to put it in the dishwasher. You're telling her to clean the dishes. And she could use cold water if she wanted to.
So you don't have to, you don't tell them how to wash
the dishes? No, of course. If you told her to put in the dishwasher, of course not. But you're telling her to clean my dishes.
However she does.
And up to you, how do you decide how you want to do it? She decides to go and put it in, then it's her problem, not mine. I didn't tell her to do that. Or, let's say,
is it alright for me to use the dishwasher?
Say, up to you, whatever you want. Yeah. Yeah. That's it. If you're in a hotel and you want the porter to bring something up to you, right? You're on the 10th floor and bring it up. Now, he's going to have to go up the lift, but theoretically he can go up the stairs. That's fine. Because you haven't told him to use the lift. It's only a sort of ask him to do something when you're explicitly telling him to do so. If, however, there is a permissible way of doing it, then you may ask him to do it in the general way, and then he can decide to do it in the forbidden way, and that's not your problem. That's his problem. Again, the three things don't apply then, because I haven't told him to do anything. It's not my mystery to do that wrong thing. I didn't intend to do that. And it's not going to cause me to do it. Because
reducing the heating.
Sorry?
Reducing the temperature of the heating.
So again, the same thing. So you have to get around Amira and Hana'a. You have to get around the speaking and the benefit. So benefit, whenever you're doing your reduction, it's not considered the benefit. Right? It's like switching off the lights. So you'd be allowed to tell him, but you can't instruct him, just a hint. It's too hot to. And then he has to work out to turn it down. Right? But you can't, but to switch it on, the heating, if it's not cold, like we said before, just you want it just to be a bit warmer, you can't. Even if you hint, same idea, you can't hint. Hinting just gets you around Amira, it doesn't get you around Hana'a, it doesn't get you around the benefit issue. If you're getting a direct benefit, then you cannot hint to the au pair.
So that would mean they couldn't tell them it's hot and they could reduce the heating, but they couldn't turn on the air conditioning, that would tell them not to do that, because then it would be a direct benefit.
turning on the air conditioning.
Unless it's really boiling.
Because then it'll be shudder shudder makom tzar, you mean? Yeah. Correct. You can tell, yes. Unless it's extremely, you know, you can't spend the day there. Then you could. Otherwise you wouldn't be allowed to. Whereas turning it down, just if you're not comfortable, it's just, you know, a bit too hot, then you could just hint to him to do so and be fine. Now, there are three things. Shvut de shvut. You may ask a non-Jew to do something forbidden by the Hasamim. You may ask a non-Jew to do something forbidden midrabanan. I'm going to close up now, just 2 more minutes, and we'll summarize. So you may ask a non-Jew to do a drabanan. There's a mitzvah involved. If there's considerable pain involved, or there's great financial loss involved. One of those three. If you have one of those three, then you're allowed to ask a non-Jew to do something forbidden on a rabbinic level. Is that clear?
Financial pain.
Great financial pain, tzar gadol, yeah. Great pain, mm-hmm. Discount, and also mitzvah.
Uh-huh.
For one of those three things, I may ask a non-Jew explicitly to do something forbidden by the Hachamim. So what was your question there? Did you ask? Okay, that's a shvut, tzarech gadol. So asking non-Jew to do something rabbinic, electricity, when there's no other alternative, and there's, you know, need to sleep there. But just to ask him to open the door to get your t-shirt, it's going to be a problem, by the way. Now,
what about the
just
lift?
What about the lift?
And the lift in Shabbat, if you go inside the lift, you're allowed to go to join in?
Well, that's a good question. What's so funny? It's a very good question.
In the hospital.
It's a good question.
No, I mentioned hotel. I mean, if somebody...
No, it's a good question. The honest answer is that you have to investigate the whole elevators, how they work, the science behind it, which I haven't done. The poskim talk about it. Some say yes, some say no. I personally haven't. I don't know exactly how the science works. You know, whether you're adding on. It depends. Each elevator is different. It's not so simple. It's a difficult topic. This
might be more issue of the sense of the doors, no?
No, the door's anyway opening. You're going in with him.
No, because
he opens with you.
You can.
Yeah.
They might be sent.
Okay, that's not so much a problem. The problem is more the weight, mm-hmm. Your weight, if
yeah,
it adds or not. It would be better. You better take stairs. If there's no alternative.
And use the Shabbos lift or not?
Yeah, it's the whole thing. It's the whole science behind the elevators, how they work exactly.
Maybe if it's a
I'm not actually. I'm
no,
not.
If it's a Shabbos well versed.
Somebody chole.
Yeah, for sure, definitely chole can. An old person definitely can. Fine, there's more to say here, but that's the main overview with regards to instructing a non-Jew. I'll take general questions. I just want to finish off by saying two things. Number one is that this brings us to the end of this 14th shiur. And Baruch Hashem, it's been a long winter. It's been a very long winter. And it's been a great series. It's been wonderful seeing everyone. I think it's been a great zechut that we've had to learn these halachot together. A great merit. This is, as I said, the first lecture all the way back in October. Shabbat is something which comes every week, and we get so used to it, and we tend to forget all its intricacies and all the halachot. And it's so important to have a reminder every few years, but one can't do it. But again, as I said, the first year, I'm going to say this again, one cannot reduce Shabbat to all that we've learned. There is a overriding element of Shabbat, the spirit of Shabbat, and you know, many times I said things, halachot, and people said, spirit of Shabbat, said, yeah, we're here to discuss the halachot, but there is, of course, always the spirit of Shabbat, and which sometimes you cannot put down to yes or no, mutar or asur. It's the feeling of Shabbat, it's the enjoyment of Shabbat, it's the wholeness of Shabbat, it's the aura of Shabbat, which people need to naturally feel. And like I gave the example, the beautiful painting consists of very fine details, and every detail adds to the beauty of the painting. If you hone in on one little detail of the painting, then you lose the whole picture. Yeah? You need to have the details. Without details, there's no picture, there's no painting, and therefore we need all these details. At the end of the day, there is that beautiful painting, spirit of Shabbat, the whole painting and the beauty, the panorama of Shabbat, which is so amazing and so important in our lives. And that's everything. Another point I want to say is everything we've learned is just literally just opened up ideas to you. As you can see and imagine, there's so much more to learn. To even try to do this in all of Hilchot Shabbat in 14 lectures is, you know, was extremely difficult. As you saw, we were always behind because there was so much to talk about. But, you know, at least we have the ideas, and you know when there's a question to be asked, you know what there is to learn more about. And if I had the ability in being able to do that, then I'll be very happy and fortunate that I've been able to share this Torah and Halachot with others. Going forward, B'zot Hashem, next term, we're going to have, in the summertime, we have a short summer this year because Pesach is so late. So we have May, June and July, 2.5 to 3 months. B'zot Hashem, we're going to do a small mini-series on Kashrut then. It'll be about 7 to 8 lectures, B'zot Hashem, on Kashrut, again on Tuesday nights, and we'll have details, the exact dates we'll send out soon. And then B'zot Hashem, after Sukkot, we'll get out for the year, the entire year, from Sukkot till the summer, a full year on the Yud Gimel Ikarim, the 13 principles of faith of the Rambam. That's going to take us a full year. There's a lot to talk about. It'll be over the winter and the summer. We'll go B'zot Hashem through systematically introduction of the principles of faith are, and through each one, understanding what they are, if there are any disagreements about them, and how they relate to our lives, etc. That will be B'zot Hashem, a big series, and that will be from next year after, well, next Jewish year after Sukkot, all the way through the year. So to summarize, well, next term we'll have a short series on Kashrut, and the Halachot, and maybe a bit of the reasons for it as well, perhaps. And then the following year, we'll have a series on the 13 claims. Anyone who wants to be informed of these, Barbara, you will have the, you know, you'll have the sheets. Anyone give the details to Barbara, who will.
Almost everybody's signed up. Yeah, make sure I get the ones.
Yeah, I think if people don't have reminders, you know, we began in the winter, there were many more, you know, the house was full. But people, as it happens, people forget, and that's how it goes. And if you want a reminder each week, I think that will help to encourage people. So B'zot Hashem, that will be next term. After Pesach, we'll resume with Kashrut. Any questions before we end the evening? Yeah.
Generally,
you can ask any questions on Shabbat. Or
so people can do anything on Shabbat for after Shabbat, right? They can prepare clothing or whatever else, and maybe wash it, that you're definitely not going to use on Shabbat.
You can't tell them to.
You can't tell them to, but in before Shabbat you can. If they're coming to work on Shabbat, they can get on with the washing if they know that it's not for Shabbat and so on.
You can't tell them explicitly to do so.
Not even before Shabbat?
No.
Even
it depends how the guy is employed. It's a complicated topic.
Okay.
It depends how the guy is employed.
Okay. And the other question,
if the guy is employed for work, generally not per hour, then yes. If he's employed for per hour, then you can't.
Okay. Which washing? The dishes?
No, that's it.
Like clothes? Or weekday clothes?
You can do washing of clothes?
No, you can't. Uh-huh. You can't.
And the other thing is, it's more lenient with asking Goy if it's for a communal benefit, right?
Correct. Then you only need one. Then even you can often do Doraita. That's only Makom Tzorech Gadol. Like an Eruv goes down.
Okay.
If the Eruv goes down.
Yeah.
And that means everyone's going to be carrying on Shabbat.
Yeah.
So you can ask the Goy to do a Doraita.
Well, maybe people use them like in a shul for, you know, if
correct.
It helps and so on. So at what point, what about if it's a Shabbat meal and you've got guests? Is that communal?
It's. I think this heter has been overused.
Okay.
Seriously overused. And by the way, the one who says this heter is the Baal Eter, and the Ramah brings it down. The Shulchan Aruch doesn't bring it down. It's not clear Maran himself actually held at this.
For general, you mean for
even for
benefits.
Big mitzvah. So for an area, fine.
Okay.
For a community, fine. You know, we rely on it for a community. We do. But you go and extend it to a big Shabbat lunch, it's very difficult to do so.
Yeah.
You know, really one shouldn't rely on this at all.
I read, and I think this is correct, that if it's the Ikarim of the meal, you could, you know, you'd left the chicken somewhere. Like, it could be brought, but not all the other things around it.
So
if there were, like, lots of salads. Or the chalot or something like that.
No, so you're talking about asking him to do something forbidden by the Darbanan. So to bring it through a camp,
yeah.
He's asking, no, the writer. Therefore, communal purpose, you're allowed to ask a Doraita. Well, you're right, it's true, because that's, like we said before, shvut, the shvut makom mitzvah. So what you're saying is only the chicken, I mean, serious stuff, that's the mitzvah. All the extra stuff isn't part of the mitzvah. The Mishnah Berurah says it's only what you need actually for the meal. That's asking to do Rabban, so to bring the chicken through a karmelit, but not something forbidden by the Torah, to carry through a real Rishut Arabi.
And what do you do if you need to walk somewhere but there's like a sensor on the doors that will open and there's no one around?
That's custody afterwards. It's, yeah, that's explained to you afterwards.
Is there any permissible way that a Jew could own a business that trades in Shabbat?
There is. It's extremely complicated. You have to draw up a whole contract. There is a way to do it. If it's a, this is a practical question? If there is a way to do it, it's very complex. But there is. If you own, you own with a non-Jew. You're in partnership.
Say, for example, I wanted to buy the AA, right? And I know that they're picking up people in the street with their cars on Shabbat.
So you own.
I wanted to buy a business like something like that.
Right. So you're the shareholder, your main shareholder in the business. I see you asking something else. So you're asking if you have a non-Jewish partner, can the non-Jewish partner work on Shabbat? So that you should know there is. There is a way around it. There is a to split the profits. There is a way, but again, it's very complex. How do you need a bed in to do it? If you have a non-Jewish partner, for him to continue to work on Shabbat, and you make sure you have to work, make an agreement that you're not getting any profits on Shabbat, and that's to be made very clear that he's running the business, right? You want to do with it. There is a way around it. With regards to owning a business which operates on Shabbat, you're the shareholder. I have to think about that. I can't answer that. She is a nidah.
So you when you need to pass the baby, do you just put the baby on the bed and then the person picks up the baby? Or?
Yeah, correct. But once the baby reaches about 6 months or so, or more, and the baby can move for itself, then considering the baby itself is moving, you're not passing it. Less than 6 months, you're just moving the baby's.
Yeah.
You're moving, so you're actually transferring and handing it from hand to hand.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's a bit older, then it moves off its own accord. Once the baby gets about 6 months and you put into it, you know, the father into the mother, and it moves off its own accord into the mother, and that's the time. Okay, Chazak Baruch, everyone. Have a great Chag Kasher v'Sameach. Everyone have a nice Pesach, and thank you all for coming.